Well, it's really good to see everybody here this morning. I want to encourage you to have your Bibles open to start with in James chapter 3. We're going to look at a few things in James chapter 3 here in a few moments. Our lesson title today is called That Which Defiles. And there's a kind of a recent event that we're going to allude to in this lesson. I think you'll recognize here in just a few moments. But let's start in James chapter 3, beginning in verse 2. I want to talk a little bit about the kind of language that we use and the way that words have power over the course of our lives. In James 3 and verse 2, "For we all stumble in many ways. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, well, he's a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well. Now, if we put the bits into the horse's mouth so that they may obey us, we direct their entire body as well. Behold, the ships also, though they are so great and are driven by strong winds, are really just directed by a very small rudder, wherever the inclination of the pilot desires. So also the tongue is a small part of the body, and yet it boasts of great things. Behold, how great a forest is set aflame by such a small fire." Verse 6. "The tongue is a fire, the very world of iniquity. The tongue is set among our members as that which defiles the entire body and sets on fire the course of our life and is set on fire by hell." And it goes on to say in verse 7 that every species of bird and beast is and reptiles and creatures of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by the human race. But no one, he says in verse 8, can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil and full of deadly poison. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the likeness of God. Let's add to that the thought in Matthew chapter 15 and verse 11. In Matthew 15, beginning in verse 11, this is what Jesus says himself on the power of language. He says, "Now what enters into the mouth defiles the man." Not what enters in the mouth defiles the man, but what proceeds out of the mouth. This defiles the man. Go on to verse 13. "Every plant which my heavenly Father did not plant shall be rooted up. Let them alone. They are blind guides to the blind. And if a blind man guides a blind man, both will fall into the same pit," he says of the Pharisees. "Explain the parable," Peter asks him in verse 15. In verse 16, this is really where we're getting in this text. "Are you still lacking in understanding also? Do you not understand that everything that goes into the mouth passes into the stomach and is eliminated? So, whatever you eat, that's not really what defiles you. That's not what defiles you spiritually. Whether a man eats with clean hands or unclean hands, or whether he eats pork or not. I mean, what enters the mouth is not that which spiritually defiles the man. It's the things he says in verse 18 that proceed out of the mouth from the heart. Those things defile him. Verse 19 and 20 of Matthew 15. "For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, slanders. These are the things which defile the man, but to eat with unwashed hands, that does not defile the man." Now, can you think of a recent event where a man's words really got him in trouble? Maybe not necessarily the words he spoke out of his mouth, but maybe some of the things that he texted to a teammate. A few months ago, Jonathan Martin, a player for the Miami Dolphins professional football team, left the team over what he said at the time was just a locker room culture that got to him. He didn't at first blame anyone in particular. He simply said, "This was a locker room culture. It was a work environment that just got to me. I couldn't take the pressure anymore. I couldn't take what was laid upon me." So he had to leave the team for a time to seek emotional and psychological treatment. As things started to unravel in this story, though, the more that people dug into the story, the more they realized there might, in some way, be a focal point to what Jonathan Martin was experiencing. Now, I'm not saying that Jonathan Martin is the most sympathetic character in the world, so that's not the point of what I'm saying. But over the course of about a year, a fellow teammate named Richie Incognito sent Jonathan Martin over 1,100 racist and profane text messages, coupled with that locker room environment where Incognito was known by other teammates to be a bully of sorts to this Jonathan Martin. Now, whatever you want to think about Jonathan Martin is fine. He knew what he was getting into. It's not like anybody starts playing football thinking that these are a bunch of ballerinas that they're going to be working with. Nobody assumes that an NFL locker room is a place for moral people to thrive. So think what you want about Jonathan Martin. He's not the object of our lesson. I want to look a little bit more at Richie Incognito. Richie Incognito never thought that what he wrote would become public knowledge. He never thought those text messages, he never thought any of the things that he said to him in the locker room would become public, dirty laundry. He has reportedly harassed and bullied him, though, for quite some time, as well as other Dolphins employees and players. Of note, back in 2009, fellow NFL players actually voted, this is NFL-wide, voted Richie Incognito to be the dirtiest player in the NFL. Refs and fellow players know him to be someone who has low integrity. His contention, though, in all of this, when all this became public and he was painted as a racist monster, his contention in all of this is that his text messages and his behavior to Jonathan Martin in the locker room are completely taken out of context. That he's not as vile and evil as he seems to be. And at least in part, I understand that. That if you have a work environment where profanity and, I was just kidding, racism is regular everyday occurrences, I understand that if you take a snippet of that out of context, paste it all over ESPN, yes, pretty much anybody in the NFL is going to look like a monster. So I agree with that. Consider some of the things that he says of himself. This is Jonathan Martin, Richie Incognito, in an interview defending his integrity. He says, "I'm not a racist, and to judge me by that one word, I would assume the bad one, is wrong. In no way, shape, or form is it ever acceptable for me to use that word, even if it's friend to friend on a voicemail. I regret that." Well, that's good. I'm glad that you regret it. But it's interesting that these same lessons that become obvious and clear to us after we get in trouble are never as clear and obvious to us while we're getting in trouble. Incognito goes on to say, all this stuff coming out, it just speaks to the culture of our locker room. It speaks to the culture of our closeness. It speaks to the culture of our brotherhood. Incognito claims that his treatment of Jonathan Martin in using racial slurs and a year's worth of subtle psychological bullying, some probably not so subtle bullying in there as well, he claims that it's nothing but how we treat each other in our locker room. We're just brothers. We're having fun. We're ribbing each other. It's just the workplace environment. It sounds terrible, he says. Well, he goes on to say, it sounds terrible. It sounds, when it's on the screen, as in printed all over ESPN, it sounds like I'm a racist pig. It sounds like I'm a meathead. It sounds like a lot of things that it's not. And I want to clear the air just by saying, I'm a good person. Now, Richie Incognito's moral character is not the point of our lesson. So I don't want you to think that's what we're going to talk about. This is a jumping off point for the rest of the lesson. Think what you want about it. And I agree, he's probably not as vile a human being as he seems to be in out-of-context messages and voicemail and that sort of thing. But when you make the contention that vileness and profanity and racism can be dismissed simply because that's how we treat each other, when you make the contention that I'm a good person in spite of what the overwhelming evidence seems to indicate, I think that there's an incongruity there between who you say you are and who you actually are in practice. That's Matthew chapter 12, which was already read earlier in the worship service. You know a bad tree by its bad fruit, just like you know a good tree by its good fruit. When you can identify bad fruit, you say, well, that's a bad tree. I think that's so true of the things that we say to each other. Our words and our actions, they're like fruit hanging from a tree. Some of the things that we say falls off like rottenness, and people pick it up and go, oh, that's bad fruit, and it must have come from a bad tree. So don't be surprised, and don't be shocked when people judge you because of what you say and you do. It's a little bit unfair. It's a little bit unfair to get upset with people when they judge you for all of the things that you present to them. We say don't judge a book by its cover, and yet there's a reason why people design covers, right? We say don't judge a book by its cover, but there's a reason why people get paid a lot of money to put graphics and fonts and quotes and pictures on the cover of a book. Because they know we do judge a book by its cover. And so what you say and what you do most certainly contributes to the kind of person that you are. Jesus says in Matthew 12, again, like we already read earlier in the worship service, he says, every single word that you say, even the words that you didn't mean to say, every word that slips out of your mouth, that's going to be presented on the judgment day. And you will be held accountable for it. Our words reveal a lot about us. Proverbs chapter 26, and in 26 specifically, says that a man's wickedness will be revealed before the assembly because of his words. I like that quote there. Because of what you say, because of what you do, your wickedness will be revealed to the assembly. As in, your dirty laundry becomes public knowledge. And I think that's what's happening to this Dolphins player right now. Again, he never intended for his 1,100 racist profane text messages to become public dirty laundry. But we live in a time when nothing is hidden anymore. You can't hide anything. Not that you ever really could hide anything from God. I've always liked Numbers 32, verse 23. Be sure that your sins will find you out. 1 Timothy chapter 5 also says that some men's sins are quite obvious. They go before them to judgment. So it's not like you could ever really hide anything from God in the first place, but certainly in our culture, in our day and age, with the digital technology that we have, where everything is recorded and categorized, where everything is out there for people to see, you can't hide it anymore. You can't hide it anymore. Controlling our online persona is as important as controlling the things that we actually say in person. What you say and what you do online is a part of who you are. We always think there's a kind of a disconnect. We think that who we are when we're just random Duck fan 1983 making a comment on the internet, we think that doesn't contribute to who we are. Just because you're making an anonymous comment on the internet with profanity doesn't mean that God doesn't know exactly who you are. So we'll make some applications here. I want to talk about some of the things that relate to how we communicate with each other, especially things that are remembered, things that are online, how you act on Facebook, how you use Twitter, how you make comments on the internet. And there's a lot of applications here. And I think the rest of the lesson, I hope you'll see, is going to be a very practical lesson, things that we can take home with us today and start living right now. Few practical applications here. You don't need to have a Twitter opinion about everything. Right? You don't need to have a Twitter opinion about everything. I think it's like you go to a restaurant, you see somebody's outfit, and you're putting pictures on Instagram. You know, you say, like, oh, no, she didn't. And you put a picture of somebody's outfit from Walmart, peopleofwalmart.com, right? We have to have an opinion. Yeah, everybody who got that is like, oh, no. We feel like we have to have an opinion about everything and that we have to post that opinion. And so we fill up our Twitter feed and our Facebook page. We have a thought about every possible thing. And yet Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 19. What does Proverbs 10 and verse 19 say about having an opinion about everything? Or at least voicing your opinion about everything. When there are many words, transgression is unavoidable. But he who restrains his lips is wise. You ever read stories about celebrities, football coaches, politicians, who put something on Facebook or Twitter just spur of the moment, and then it's a firestorm, and they're a racist, and then they have to go and make a big apology about it, make a big public apology. Maybe if you didn't post your opinion about every single thing in the world, you would be less likely to post something that's offensive or rude or downright wrong. I think that also goes along with the instant response culture that we have. You read any article. You go to FoxNews.com, CNN.com, ESPN.com. You go to anybody's blog page, and what's always at the bottom of the blog or the article? Comment sections. Comment sections, that always makes me think of that scene in Star Wars where Obi-Wan Kenobi and Luke Skywalker are looking down at that town on Tatooine, and Obi-Wan Kenobi says, you know, you will never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy. To me, that's the comment section of every internet article ever. It's like moths to a flame. Just the worst people say the worst things totally anonymously because there's no consequence to it. So we have this instant response. Every time we read something, every time we hear something, we have to say something right then without ever putting the filter on. We don't filter out. Because, you know, sometimes the first thought that you have about something is not the best thought to have about something. Proverbs 12 and verse 16. Proverbs 12 verse 16 says, a fool's vexation is known at once. As in all the stuff that makes a fool mad, he has to say it right away. Just no filter, just comes right out of his mouth. But a prudent man conceals dishonor. Maybe when you read an article that upsets you or a blog post that makes you mad, or if you're overhearing a conversation on the bus between two people, put the filter on. You don't always have to say everything right away. Once written, harsh words can never be taken back. I know that's just absolutely true. That if you post something, if you put something out there in the world, whether it's the internet or words that you say to a person in reality, what you say cannot be taken back. And our words, like Proverbs 12 verse 18 kind of alludes to, our words end up becoming like thrusts of a dagger. You know, you can go like that with a dagger, and if you stab somebody, it's not that you go, oh, my bad, and you can't take it back. Once you stab somebody, that's pretty much it. You stabbed a guy, you're going to jail. There's no getting around that. Jokes are often a very thin veneer for hate speech also. Like a madman in Proverbs 26, like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death, so is the man who deceives his neighbor and says, was I not joking? Maybe that's a little bit of Richie Incognito. You can send 1,100 racist text messages where you use the N-word all the time and say that you're going to murder a man's biracial mother. I'm just kidding! Dude, don't take it so seriously! I'm just joking! Again, jokes are often a very thin veneer for things that we actually believe that are hateful or rude or wrong. And in the digital age, gossip spreads even faster than ever. Proverbs 26 verses 20 and 21 talks about gossip being like a flame, and our words fan that flame. Every time you say something to contribute to the gospel, to the gossip, you are making it worse. You're making the flame even bigger. Another lesson here, your workplace culture. It just speaks to the culture of our brotherhood. It just speaks to the environment of our locker room, Incognito says. I don't know. To me, it's a rather cheap excuse to blame workplace environment for poor moral behavior. It is a challenge, and I get it that some workplaces are worse than others, but I think that's where the Christian just has to rise above the low expectations that surround him. This excuse might work for unbelievers. They might be able to get away with it, but we have to rise above the world and stand apart. Like Joshua says in Joshua 24, you can do whatever you want. You can believe or you cannot believe. You can obey God or you cannot obey God. But as for me and for my house, we will serve the Lord. I don't care what anybody else does around me. I don't care what the workplace environment is or what the culture of my profession is. I'm going to stand above all of that. Which leads to a couple practical applications on your workplace. This is especially for our young people here today. Think about this. Don't wait until you're in the middle of a career before deciding this is a bad environment. Now, I think what happens is young people get excited about a career, they're excited about an opportunity, and they get into it and they realize 10 years later, you know, this is really not a career that's conducive to being a Christian. It's really not. Don't wait until you're done with college and you've been working at something for 10 or 20 years before you finally decide, you know, this just isn't for a Christian. I was a music major my first year in college. I was actually a jazz studies major. You didn't know about that about me, probably. I was a jazz studies major, but I realized something, that spending my Fridays and Saturdays and probably a lot of Sundays playing jazz in smoky blues clubs surrounded by sleazies just probably wasn't the environment for a Christian. So I stopped doing what it was I enjoyed doing because I knew the path that it was going to take me down. There are jobs that make it hard to be a Christian. There are workplace environments that make it hard to be a Christian. What you need to do then, young people, is ask around. Ask people who are part of that workplace, who are part of that career path, and ask them, has it been easy for you? Has it been hard for you? What are the challenges that you face in terms of defeating sin in your workplace environment? And know that stuff before you jump in head first, because we're always going to be surrounded by the world. So don't act shocked when you encounter it. You know, a person becomes an NFL linebacker and they're like shocked by all the profanity that's in there. Like, what have you been doing? Can't you read lips on TV? I'm sorry, but they can bleep stuff out or you can like pan on the coach or something. But when you're watching an NFL or a college football game and they're showing what the coach is doing on the sideline, like, dude, can't you read lips? I'm telling you, kids, don't become a professional athlete. Just don't. You're a lot better off being an accountant than a professional athlete. Don't be shocked when you find out that there's sin in the world. Invest in meaningful relationships with other Christians, because the temptation to conform, I think, will lessen if you actually have some strong influence going the other way. Now, another point. Being a quote-unquote good person. Being a good person. Richie Incognito concludes all of his interview by saying, I just want to clear the air and make sure that people know I'm a good person. But how do I know if you're a good person? I could just take your word for it. You know, you could be a racist meathead, but I could just take your word for it. I promise you, I'm a good person. Based on what? Yeah, again, his character is not the point of our lesson, because there's an application here for all of us. You claim to be a Christian, don't you? You wear the name of Christ. So, you're certainly willing to talk the talk. But when it comes to actually living the life of a Christian, are you willing to walk the walk? You claim to be a Christian. But what do your actions and what do your words say to either corroborate or disprove the claim that you're making? Being a good person. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 5. Because there's some great lessons here in Ephesians 5 about being a good person. Some lessons that I wish that a lot more people would take to heart. In Ephesians 5, notice in verses 1 and 2, therefore be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. Part of walking the walk, part of being a good person in the eyes of God, is living like God. I mean, you have four Gospels. It's not like our information about Jesus' walk through life is scant. You have four biographies about the Son of God. There is plenty of information that we can go off that says, if you want to live like Christ, this is how you do it. You obey Him. You follow His example. And you love other people the way that Christ loved us. You forgive other people. You show grace to other people. You assume the best about other people. And you're always careful that your words are there to educate and edify rather than to destroy the hope and the possibility of a person finding salvation. That's being a good person. Being an imitator of God is being a good person, because God is really the only true good that we can find. There's nothing on this earth that we can say is a true, pure good apart from God. I'm a good person, but I use profanity. I'm a good person, but I walk the line and walk the edge when it comes to moral issues, like drinking, like how close I'm going to get to that person that I'm dating. I'm a good person, though. I'm a good person, but I'm always pushing the boundaries of morality. But I'm a good person. No, a good person is someone who imitates God. Notice in verse 3. But do not let immorality or impurity or greed even be named among you as is proper among saints. And there must be no filthiness and silly talk or coarse jesting which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. I like how it gives us an alternative. Don't do all of that stuff. Just give thanks. Be a grateful person. Live with the gratitude of a God-fearing person. For this you know in verse 5 with certainty, that no immoral or impure person or covetous man who is an idolater has an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you, he says, with empty words. For because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Well, I'm a good person, but I like a dirty limerick every now and then, just like the next guy. I'm a good person, but when I turn a TV program on and it says TVMA, I don't really take that to heart. Those are just suggestions, guidelines. I've always thought, if some random secular body can watch a TV show and from a secular perspective say, you know what, this is kind of an iffy program. You know, we need to put some guidelines on here that says TVMA. If a random secular body can recognize that something is iffy, morally speaking, should a Christian go, oh yeah, TVMA, oh, I love that show, man, that's great, that's one of my favorites, if you ignore the swearing and everything. Isn't it funny when you meet Christians like that? Where they say, well, aside from all the profanity in that movie was great. Well, if you can get past that nude scene, that was a really good. If you can get past all the profanity, like, if your entertainment requires you to get past profanity to get to anything worth watching, do not let immorality or impurity or greed even be named among you as is proper among saints. Immorality and impurity should be so far away from us that we don't even let it be named among us. It is so far away from us that it's not even associated with us, not affiliated with us, not even a part of our lives. A good person doesn't push the boundaries. A good person looks at immorality and goes the opposite direction, as far away from that impurity as he or she can get. That's a good person. Pick up in let's skip on down to verse 7 here. Therefore, do not be partakers with them. Do not be partakers? What if I partake just a little bit? What if I just partake socially? What if I just partake just to a certain degree or a certain extent that I know that I'm safe and I can get away with it? For you were formerly darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. For the fruit of the light consists in all goodness and righteousness and truth. Trying to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. I like that he says trying. You're not always going to be perfect. And we as Christians, we do not stand before the world as perfect judges of everybody else's behavior. Like anybody else, we are trying to learn what is the right thing. Now, I might fail, but the big difference between a Christian and an unbeliever is that the Christian is trying. He's striving. And when he makes mistakes, he learns from them and moves on. When he commits sin, he learns how to do better the next time. He's trying to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. Verse 11, "And do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them." Fight against them. It's not just about avoiding immorality and just saying, "Well, I see, you guys can do whatever you want. I'm going to stand over here apart from the immorality of the world." There's even an exposure there. There's fighting against it. There's trying to defeat it, trying to destroy it. Verse 12, "For it is disgraceful even to speak of the things which are done by them in secret." That's how far away from immorality we need to be. That we even find it uncomfortable to talk about sin. Not that we find it uncomfortable to deal with it, to confront it, but that just the idea of sin makes us just wary. I don't want to push the limits. Because a good person, by God's standard, a good person might fail at times and will still have sin that needs to be dealt with. But a good person says, "I'm going to do my very best to go the opposite way." Finish out this context in verses 13 and 14 now. "But all things become visible when they are exposed by the light. For everything that becomes visible is light. For this reason it says, 'Awake, sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine upon you.'" There's a call then. You were in darkness. You were asleep. And it's not a good kind of sleep either, not a restful kind of sleep. You were asleep in the nightmare of sin. It's time to awake, O sleeper. It's time to arise from the dead. It's time to light the flame of God in your heart and see for the first time the path to heaven that is laid out before us all. We need the illumination that comes with the gospel in our lives. We need the illumination of truth and not filthiness. Not profanity. I'm not Richie Incognito's judge. And I hope you not get that impression from this lesson. But I think that he serves as a good object lesson. He regrets what he said. Because what he said is now public knowledge. There's a lot of things that we regret also. Be careful about sending that text message. Be careful about clicking on that link. Be careful about judging somebody harshly before you know the whole story. Be careful about butting into somebody's business without knowing what's really going on. Be careful about testing the waters of sin with your toe like a creek. You want to be a good person? You can't do it on your own, and you certainly can't do it by following the world's standards. A good person is an imitator of God, and it starts with imitating the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. When you can imitate His death, burial, and resurrection through baptism, you become a part of His body. You become a part of His kingdom, His church, and you serve Him awakened, brightened, alive. So whatever need you might have this morning, please, come forward as we stand and sing.